as well. Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. Oh, thank you, thank you very much. Thank you, thank you. My very, very special thanks to these very charming ladies that have, oh, what a banner you've unfurled. For a while, I just wanted to get behind it, fellas, if you know what I mean. Thank you so very much. Dear friends, and I think that's the very best and the most appropriate way to address you tonight. My very dear friends, thank you so much for welcoming me to this dinner. And particularly may I say to Ed Toohey, thanks so very, very much for your generous introduction, speaking as you do from your position of leadership here in the Philadelphia AFL-CIO. I think Ed's a great labor leader and a great fellow and a great gentleman. I was so pleased tonight to hear the wonderful round of applause that you gave to my governor back there, George Leader. Oh, that made me feel real good when I knew how much you appreciated his leadership. And then when you gave that applause over here to Jersey Joe Walcott, that worried me because I think Jersey Joe may want to run for another office. I'm worried about that. God bless you. What a gentleman. What a gentleman. Not only a great champion, but what a wonderful, genuine spirit and soul is Jersey Joe. And God bless him. I'm so glad that he's here with us. And my thanks to each and every member of the congressional delegation that have come here tonight. Can I just say to this audience that you're mighty lucky? You have good, progressive, solid, constructive, effective congressmen, all five of them that are here tonight, and I want to compliment them. The words that I've heard tonight from Jim Tate were almost more than a sentimental man like myself can take. I guess it is no secret that I am, as Jim is, rather sentimental about friends and dear ones. I had no idea that this good mayor, this friend of yours and this friend of mine, was going to speak as he did tonight. The only thing I can say to him is that I am so unbelievably moved by his testimony, by his generous words, by his fearless presentation, by his loyalty, and by his commitment that I shall never, never forget it. Never. It'll always be remembered. Thank you, Jim. I'm so glad that Ann returned, because every time I look at that pretty Ann, I think of my pretty Muriel. I really do. And let me just say a word from her, because she's in Florida tonight. Old ladies, I know she's enjoying it too. The climate's nice down there, but I got a little contest going on down there, and there are a lot of folks that don't really care too much about me, but they love my Muriel. So I just let her go, and she just campaigns for me. And every once in a while, somebody will say, well, you know, they'll say to me, I don't know about you, Hubert. Really, I've had some doubts about you, and frankly, I'm not much for you, but I do like Muriel. And I say to them, look, we come together. Take the package. No other way, no other way. Now let me get some thank yous out of the way, because I want to get down to business. I'm going to talk to you tonight. We're going to have a revival meeting around here, believe me. We are. We're going to scare the devil out of somebody, and we're going to also get somebody. We're going to start the progress tonight, the progress of Nixon is through in 72. And we're going to start that right here tonight. First thing I want to say is a very hearty, sincere thanks to Philadelphia Cope, to Pennsylvania Cope, to National Cope, to the labor movement of this country. Let me just lay it on the line. 1968 was not a good year for any of us. A year of tragedy, a year of emotion and passion, a year of tragic death and assassination. Two of our great leaders, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy. A year of fire and tension and violence, a year of war, and yet it was the year that I carried the banner of this party. It wasn't an easy assignment, but it was a great honor. There were some that didn't rally to that banner because they thought there wasn't a dime of difference between Nixon and Humphrey. Ladies and gentlemen, the people in this room knew there was more than a dime of difference. They knew that there was a world of difference. This mayor of mine and yours knew it too, and he went to work for me. He never stopped. And Philadelphia gave me a majority that will live in my memory forever. And Pennsylvania gave me a majority. And let me say to you out here that want a Democratic president, that no Democrat in this century has been elected without carrying the state of Pennsylvania. You got to carry the state of Pennsylvania. And you have to carry it big in the city of Philadelphia. That's where it starts. And that's where we're starting here tonight. I'm not here just to speak for myself. That'll come. I'll let you judge. I'm here to speak for the Democratic Party, for the labor movement of this country, for forward-looking people. I'm here to speak for your congressman. I'm here to speak for every one of these candidates that are in these Democratic primaries tonight. Because there isn't a one of them that I wouldn't rather have in the White House than what's there. Not a one of them. I would want to go down the line. And you'll never see the day that the man that's standing before you won't support the candidate that you people out here feel ought to be in that White House. I have been with you since I was old enough to vote and work. I have been with you in every election. I say you, I mean members of organized labor. I was recruited by the labor movement to run for mayor of Minneapolis. I started my political career with the endorsement of the labor movement. I've won with the labor movement. I've lost with the labor movement. And I'm going to win with the labor movement. And America's going to win with the labor movement. When Frank Sullivan was introduced here tonight, I said, that's my president back there. I helped organize the AFT. I started my career in teaching and workers' education in the union halls. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud of the number of honorary lifetime memberships that I have in some of these organized labor groups that are represented here tonight. And we're going to continue to be proud of it because we're going to do what's right. Now listen, the labor movement of this country has been the cutting edge of social progress in America. It has always been out front working for what needs to be done. Long before others ever dreamed of Social Security, unemployment compensation, long before others ever dreamed of what we could do to improve the lot of the man that was working long hours to abolish child labor, who was out in front? A labor movement, even with few members, a labor movement that was being harassed by a government, a labor movement that was being beaten into the streets. That labor movement was out there fighting for a better America. For the eight-hour day, against child labor, for the improvement of the working conditions, for health and welfare benefits, for federal aid to education, for civil rights and equal opportunity, for every single program that has made America great. This great organized labor movement of ours didn't wait. It didn't get to the back of the parade, it led the parade. It took the body blows, it was the vanguard. And I want it to be the same thing in the days ahead. We can't look back. Those days are days of achievement and accomplishment, days of sadness and sorrow, days of pain and suffering, but also days of great victory and great achievement. There are men and women in this hall that remember Franklin Roosevelt speaking in this very city when he said, America has a rendezvous with destiny. And he literally awakened the whole world to the greatness of this country. This city right here. There are people here that remember it was in this city that Harry Truman waited for hours over here at Philadelphia Convention Hall and took that platform in 1948 when people said he didn't have a prayer and he didn't have a chance. And when he went out to the people, not to the bosses, to the people, and carried his message, and we won one of the greatest victories in the history of American politics. And it is in this very city, that John F. Kennedy packed these streets with thousands of people and rallied the people of this state to go on to win a great victory in a razor-thin, close election. Pennsylvania was the difference. Mark my words, Pennsylvania was the difference. So I speak to people that make the difference tonight. And we got something to do, big things to do. Now let me just talk to you a little bit about the big things we got to do. I'll talk about our country. I'm not going to spend my time as a candidate for public office running around demeaning the United States of America. I'm not going to prove I'm smart by proving that this country is bad. And I'm not going to try to prove that this nation is corrupted beyond redemption and that it's all loused up. I simply say to you tonight, as a premise for my remarks, that this great nation of ours has untold strength, reservoirs of goodwill, unbelievable amount of talent, skilled workforce, competent management, young, gifted youth, people that can do anything. We can move mountains. We can do anything. If somebody will just give us a sense of vision and a sense of direction and call upon this nation to live up to its greatness and to be what it can be. And that's what we're going to try to do in this year of 1972. I always worry about a man in the White House who starts talking about a game plan and eats cottage cheese and looks at football games and starts to chart the course of the government. Now, I like football games. Don't misunderstand me. And I come from the country where they make a lot of cottage cheese. I know good cottage cheese from bad cheese. But I want to say this to you. You ought to be a little worried. Let's have a little humor here tonight about a man that says he's going to lead you and that he's got this insight in what we ought to have when he started out picking the Los Angeles Angels to be the champs of the American League. And then he picked the Baltimore Orioles to win the pennant, and the Pittsburgh Pirates finished that off. And then he picked the Washington Redskins to win in football. And then to top it off, he picked Pakistan over India. And as if that wasn't enough meddling, what else did he do? We got a lot of troubles. My dear Vikings lost in the playoffs, and add insult to injury. There's a good Democrat down there with the Miami Dolphins. His name is Joseph Robbie. He was a South Dakota state senator, a Democrat, and you got to be courageous to be a Democrat in South Dakota in the days that he was one. And here was my good friend Joe Robbie with the Dolphins. They were doing just fine, and Coach Shula is in the Army Reserve, and he got an order from the Commander-in-Chief. You remember Nixon sent him a play? Yes. He sent him down to play. It was just exactly like a battle plan. He says he'd been watching. He said, now give a pass from Greasy to Paul Warfield and in and an outer. Well, you know, after all, this is the Commander-in-Chief, the main coach. He's coaching the whole country. That's why we're in a heck of a fix, as I'll come around to show you in a minute. So what happens? So now you listen to the national networks. You don't have to listen to Hubert Humphrey about this. The national broadcasters told you. They said, here's the game now with the Dallas Cowboys, the Miami Dolphins, and things are going pretty good. And all at once, the announcer says, and now Greasy's falling back. He's in the pocket. He's throwing the Nixon play to Warfield. And now listen, Paul Warfield can catch butterflies and clouds. He's got sticky fingers. He can catch anything. But when that Nixon pass came, he dropped it. So help me, he did. He not only dropped it once, he dropped it three times, and then the fourth time, they intercepted. Now, I tell you, dear friends, this country needs a new coach. Don't you think so? Oh, how I wish it were just that much fun. I really do. But it isn't. When this Republican administration took office, we were reminded within 2 months that there had to be a certain level of unemployment in order to dampen down the fires of inflation or to cool the fever of inflation. The doctor in the White House and his assistants made a prescription. And their prescription was that you, the working people of this country, were supposed to swallow a bitter pill called economic recession, a number of your members unemployment, in order to lower the fever of inflation. Now, I'm a pharmacist. That's the worst old quack remedy that any doctor ever prescribed. And a man that prescribes it is guilty of malpractice. It didn't work. Inflation continued. Unemployment mounts. Of course, one thing I will say, that no matter what you think is the fact, you may hurt, your brother may be unemployed, your grandfather may be the victim of inflation and eroded value of his dollar, but really it isn't true according to the administration. Why, I just read yesterday that unemployment was down. It was down, they said, from 6.1% down to 5.9%. And then when you got down into the small print, they admitted that there were 1 million more people unemployed in January than there were in December. But they had the figures seasonally adjusted. Now, whatever that means, I'll tell you what that means. You adjust the figures so that in the political season, it looks good for you. That's what seasonally adjusted means. Of all the nonsense that this country's ever been told, ladies and gentlemen, the economic game plan of the administration has been nothing short of a tragedy for millions of people. Oh, they said, well, wait a minute. The first game plan didn't work. The score was about 36-0, and the fans were leaving the stadium, and half the team was off the field. So they changed it, and then they put in what they call the freeze, phase one. And when the freeze came in, somebody said, well, look, the school teachers aren't getting their pay increase. The contracts that were negotiated aren't being honored. And it was, you know what a freeze is, don't you? The freeze is just like a replay when you look at the television on that Sunday pro football game and a foul is called and everybody is screaming. Was it did the referee call it right? So the television stops the play, the replay, and it stops it. And somebody got clipped. Guess who? You. You got clipped. Phase one. Then comes phase two. Controls. In the first time, had it not have been for George Meany, had it not have been for the labor movement, you would have taken the worst shellacking of your life. Mr. Meany had to insist that there be some autonomy of that board. He had to insist that some contracts be honored. And the Congress of the United States, my fellow Americans, had to pass a law by act of Congress to get this administration to honor contracts that were legally arrived at through the processes of negotiation and collective bargaining. That's what had to be done in this country. Well, they've had phase one, they've had phase two, and I've got a suggestion. We ought to write the plan for phase three. That comes on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, when we phase them right smack bang out, freeze and all. Oh yes, I know some people say, well, that's pretty tough talk. It isn't that bad, Mr. Humphrey. You're just trying to exaggerate. No, I'm not. Not one bit. We now have an administration policy that tells us that we have to be prepared to have an acceptable level of unemployment. A year and a half ago, about 2 years ago, it was 4%. A little bit later, it was 4.5%. Now, the newest acceptable level of unemployment, acceptable for you, and for your workers and your families, for this community, is 5%. That has been officially declared by the President's top economic spokesman, the Secretary of the Treasury. It has been published in the recent economic report of the President's Council of Economic Advisors that America is from here on out to have to accept, as it said, a high rate of unemployment and inflation. That's the game plan. 5%. Well, let me just lay it on the line, and let me read it so I don't have one mistaken word. There is no such thing as an acceptable level of unemployment. Hunger is not acceptable in a land of plenty. Poverty is not acceptable in a land of wealth. Poor health is not acceptable in a land of the greatest medical profession in the world. And a ruined life, which is the end product of poor health, poor education, poverty, and unemployment, is not acceptable. And I want this administration to know that a persistently high level of unemployment and a persistent inflation that eats the guts out of anybody's pocketbook have become a structural part of the Republican economic policies, and 5% unemployment is not acceptable to me. It is not acceptable to you. It is not the best that we can do. It is tragic, it is costly, and it is intolerable, and we're not going to take it. We have more unemployed today than any time in the last 10 years. More of our youth, more of our elderly, two of the groups in this country that are being tragically victimized. Over 1 million workers in the prime of their lives, 45 years of age, unemployed. 250,000 engineers, scientists, technicians, and highest skilled workers, unemployed. 10% of the building trades that have been selected out by this administration for a whiplashing, unemployed. And when it comes to the young, to these workers that I speak about, age 45 and over, listen to who they are. They're the veterans of World War II. They are experienced engineers and teachers. Some of them are heads of small business firms that were rubbed out. Some of them are farmers that went bankrupt. They're skilled workers in a host of occupations. They once were hard-working, tax-paying citizens. Then all at once, the bottom dropped out of their lives. But it's being told that it's their fault. Friends of organized labor and my brothers and sisters in this movement, you have been selected out as the scapegoat. The President of the United States saw fit to demean your national president in national convention. The finger has been pointed at you time after time. And whether we like to believe it or not, school children and unorganized workers and housewives across the length and breadth of this land are being taught by vicious propaganda day in and day out that all of it's your fault. You're getting paid too much and working too little. That's the propaganda line. And yet, what's the fact? The fact is, even in the official publications, that the American worker is the most productive worker per man hour in the world. The best. And what else are the facts? Well, I want to tell you, I've seen a lot of people enjoy good life, and I like it myself. I find very, very few people in my part of the country belonging to organized labor. The people out there in the shops and the factories, the people building those buildings or working on those highways, in good weather and bad weather, if they have a job, I find very little of them having 2 months in a yacht in the Mediterranean along the French Riviera or the Caribbean. They're lucky if they get 2 weeks in a rowboat in northern Minnesota. Isn't that a fact? Let's talk the facts. Who is it that's in debt? Who is it that spends their money? This administration wonders what it can do to get this economy moving again. Well, I'll tell you what they ought to do. They ought to figure a way to put America back to work. Let's take a look at the young people. Drug addiction in this country is epidemic. And if it isn't in your family, it's in your neighbors. And if it is in your family, you can say, well, it's in the so-called best families, quote, end quote, across the length and breadth of this land. But when you have thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of teenagers, 19, 18, and 20, standing on street corners with nothing to do, no hope, no jobs, no prospects, is it any wonder they turn to drugs, to crime, to mischief? Let me give you a sad percentage. 17% of all young men and women eligible for work between the ages of 17 and 20 are unable to find jobs. Black teenagers in the poverty areas, over 40% unemployed. Vietnam veterans in the age bracket of 20 to 24, 12% of them coming home from a tragic war that they never wanted to fight, unemployed. These are the statistics, but behind those statistics lies a broken heart, a broken body, hopelessness, and despair. And it's not only the uneducated and the underprivileged who are finding the doors closed to them. The job outlook for high school graduates this year, according to the forecast of your government, is the worst in a decade. The college student finds it to be the grimmest period since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Now, these are the facts. And all the propaganda and Madison Avenue slick tactics to the contrary cannot do away with them. I come from rural America. The farmers of this land today have a price structure related to the cost of things they have to pay that leaves them with a parity ratio only 3% higher than it was in the depth of the Depression. And the administration stands there and twiddles its thumbs and says, well, we can export it because it's so cheap, as people are driven from the land. And what are we told? Well, listen to these words. We're going to require some degree of patience on the part of the American people on the subject of unemployment, said the administration spokesman, the Secretary of the Treasury, on behalf of the President. Well, let me just say it from this platform tonight. The time for patience is past. The time for patience is over. I personally have been running out of patience. And the American worker and millions of families have run out of patience. This Republican trickle-down economics just doesn't work. What you need is somebody that understands that the base of this economy is in its people, that this is a consumer economy, that this is a worker economy. And when the working people have it, they spend it. When they don't have it, they don't spend it. And when the working people don't have it, there's trouble in America, and lots of it. Now, every one of you are facing income tax, period. If you don't pay it, the government will see you and see that you do, or take a severe penalty out of your life. The income tax law, known as the Internal Revenue Act, is the federal law. There's another law called the Employment Act of 1946, both passed by Congress, both assigned by the President. That Employment Act requires of the President of the United States and his cabinet and all offices of government the following things. Just exactly like Selective Service requires of a young man to report to the induction station. And if he doesn't, we put him in jail, don't we? Well, here is an Employment Act that says to the President of the United States and his officers of government, it is your duty and responsibility to perfect and administer such policies as will provide for, as shall provide for, maximum employment, maximum production, and maximum purchasing power. I charge this administration with a willful violation of that law. They have not kept the law. And the jury is going to hear the case. And the prosecution is going to present the case. The jury is the American people. And the prosecution will be the political candidates. What to do then about it? It doesn't do any good just to cry about it. Well, we know that this country has massive wants, crying for attention. Take a look at your own city with all that this great mayor has done and tried to do. We need safer streets. We ought to be able to walk any place, anytime. We ought to be able to feel safe in our homes. That's the first duty of government. We need more and better hospitals and clinics. A large percentage of our hospitals today are obsolete and can't even meet minimum standards. We need better schools. We've got people here arguing about busing. We have more people interested in selling buses than we have in building schools. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you what I think people want. I talked this afternoon to two fine audiences of distinguished, wonderful black people. You know what they want? What I want. What you want. They want a decent neighborhood, a decent job, decent schools, decent health. They want the same things that everybody else wants, and they're entitled to it. We need clean air, and we need clean water. We need a whole broad base of public services. We need housing by the thousands and the hundreds of thousands. We need whole new neighborhoods. We need vast amounts of housing for the elderly. We need daycare centers for mothers that are working mothers that need a place to leave their children instead of at home with no babysitter or a babysitter or in a street. And we need parks. And we need transportation, and we need airports. And let me tell you something else we need. I talked to John Fay up here tonight. I see some shipbuilders out here and some of my members of the Seafarers Union, the maritime trades. This country needs ships. We need a merchant marine in this country, and we ought to build them in America. We need docks. We need docks. We need new railroad cars. Listen, we need so much. You know what's happening to us? We're exporting our capital by the billions. By the billions. Money made off the American people, flowing out of this country like a hemorrhage. Ladies and gentlemen, 10 years ago, the balance of payments deficit was $4 billion. Tonight, it's $44 billion. What does that mean? That means money that is needed here in the United States of America to make this a better country has gone someplace else, hiring workers someplace else at lower pay, bringing in goods to take your jobs, and not reducing the cost one dime to the American consumer. There is an answer. There is an answer, and the answer is this. Let's start to rebuild America. This nation a few years ago gave $20 billion to Western Europe in the Marshall Plan to rebuild its cities. The cities of Western Europe were bombed out. They were burned out like some of ours have been. They were the victim of violence. So what did we do? We made a 5-year commitment to people overseas, even our former enemies. And we said to those people, look, we commit to you $20 billion. You can be sure of it. You won't have to beg for it. It'll be delivered on time. We'll give you our best engineers. You put your labor force to work. And ladies and gentlemen, we rebuilt with American money and a good deal of American ingenuity every major city in Western Europe that was the victim of the war. I'm not complaining, I supported it. It was a Marshall Plan for Europe. But ladies and gentlemen, if we could rebuild the cities of Western Europe to put people to work, why in the name of common sense can't we do exactly the same thing for the American people, for the American city, to put American people to work? Let me leave you tonight with a statement that was never delivered by a president, that was never permitted to finish his term of office or to fulfill his goals. Just this past week, I went to Charleston, West Virginia. I filed in the state of West Virginia in the presidential primary. I had alongside of me the campaign manager of John F. Kennedy in the campaign of 1960. In 1960, John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey carried on a mighty campaign that didn't tear this party apart, built a platform, and finally helped elect a president. And it was in West Virginia that John Kennedy won that great victory. It was in West Virginia that we put religious intolerance and bigotry out of our lives, politically at least. It used to be said you couldn't elect a Catholic, you couldn't have him on the ticket, we couldn't win. It was in West Virginia that the people of that little state proved that that was not true. And from there he went on to a great victory. The man that was the campaign manager of John Kennedy at that time was Kenny O'Donnell, who later on became President Kennedy's top assistant in the White House. Kenny O'Donnell was alongside of Hubert Humphrey this past week on Friday as we put down our fee and registered and paid the registration fee for that candidacy. When I was there, I couldn't help but think of the unfinished tasks, of the goals that this brave and gallant young president had that were never achieved. And I said to myself, we're going to finish him. We've had a lapse. We've gone through a war, which pray God could be over, which ought to be over, out of which we should get ourselves as rapidly as a human being can take that action, so we can get on with the job of healing the wounds in this country. I want to pick up that torch that the assassin's bullet took away from a young president. I want to carry that torch. I want to finish the struggle in this country, or at least I want to have something to do about forwarding it in the cause of human rights. I want to get America moving again. I want this country to think of its greatness and its excellence, not its mediocrity and its apologies. I'm tired of an administration, a government that apologizes for what we don't do, that's willing to settle for second best. I'm not willing to settle for second best in an election or in the country, ladies and gentlemen. I want us to be first, right down the line. So as you go home tonight, remember these words. November 22nd, 1963, Dallas. For this country is moving, and it must not stop. It cannot stop. For this is a time for courage, and this is a time for challenge. Neither conformity nor complacency will do. Neither the fanatics nor the faint-hearted are needed. Our duty as a party is not to our party alone, but to the nation, and indeed to all mankind. Our duty is not merely the preservation of political power, but the preservation of peace and freedom. So let us not be petty when our cause is so great. Let us not quarrel amongst ourselves when our nation's future is at stake. Let us stand together with renewed confidence in our cause, united in our heritage of the past and our hopes of the future, and determined that this land we love shall lead all mankind into new frontiers of peace and abundance. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the testament for this nation. We must do better. We must put ourselves to the task. We cannot settle for mediocrity. We can have no apology for failure. The presidency of the United States must be filled with someone who is strong enough to stand for the weak, brave enough to stand, if you please, when others flinch, and with vision enough to see the promise of this great land. Let's work together. Let's get this done. Let's take away the darkness and the shadow which is over this land today. Let the sunlight of progress and hope come blazing through to give our kids something to dream about and to give us something to work for. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
God bless you.